Do you think that like coding agents are going to make, like, it's going to cause people to become better managers? I don't know if you buy that.
It's the argument, like, are you becoming a better manager when you have children, right? And I think you do, because you have more patience.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to another episode of Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of world-class minds on artificial intelligence to make sense of the week's news. Joining us today are three brilliant panelists. We've got Krish Varshney, IBM Fellow, Lauren McHugh Olende, Program Director, AI Open Innovation, and Volkmar Ulig, CTO and VP of Data Platforms. Packed episode as always today. We're going to talk about the Ralph Wiggum prompting craze. We're going to talk a little bit about the India AI Impact Summit. We'll talk about AI ads at the Super Bowl. But I wanted to start today by talking a little bit about this fascinating blog post that came out of the Microsoft AI team, basically looking across all of their usage patterns for Copilot. There was a couple things in here that really sort of surprised me in some ways. I think this is like just the latest of a couple of sort of emerging numbers that we're starting to see that kind of reveal what it is that people use, you know, chatbots and chatbot-like assistants for on a day-to-day basis. And Krish, I think the thing that stood out to me is that it turned out that consistently the main thing that people really want out of their like chatbots seems to be health advice. Was that surprising to you at all?
Not really. That's what I've been using it for too.
But it matches your own experience.
It does. And I think what was interesting for me was just the cycles that they were showing, like on a daily basis, it had this like philosophy advice at night, on a weekly basis, like switching from gamers, becoming coders, becoming gamers, and then kind of on a seasonal yearly basis, like holidays and these sort of things. So Valentine's Day is tomorrow, and that was featured in there as well. So it's like synchronizing with our lives, or we're synchronizing our lives with it. So I don't know which way you want to look at it.
Yeah, for sure. Like, and you're saying that basically, like, it's not just that we want to talk about Valentine's Day, but it, in some ways it's like it's overall kind of shaping the kinds of things that we're thinking about on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Lauren, I think the sort of thing that I kind of had in mind here, which I think is the fun topic to get into, is in some ways, you know, what this reminds me the most about is that I remember like a number of studies from a long time ago about like, oh, what do people use Google for on a day-to-day basis? And, you know, a lot of this kind of what you might call query volume that chatbots are seeing does seem very similar to search engines. Do you think they differ in any particular ways, or is this kind of in some ways just like a repeat of what we've known? Like, obviously, there's a little bit of like voyeuristic interest, like, oh, what are other people using, you know, Copilot for? But there's a part of me that also is just like, well, this is maybe just like what Google sees. Is that right?
Yeah, I think one really big difference, though, is the sensitive nature. So, you know, people have always said that you could look at someone's Google history and kind of figure out what they're, if they're using it for work, example, figure out what they're doing in their job. You know, there might be some sensitivity that way. But with Copilot, there's definitely sensitivity that way. You're uploading things, you're generating things, you're much more precise. You're not just kind of putting topics in, but you're putting like full questions in. Oftentimes in the work context, I'm guessing a lot of these Copilot licenses that they studied were in enterprise context. So I think that's a really big difference, because with Google, you know, I'm allowed to use Google for work. There's not too big of a concern that I'm like leaking corporate information into Google. But with these systems, it's different. And then that's really important because Google is free. And I have my own Google account. But here, it's definitely not free. It's not free for me to use. And then it's not free to like actually produce these things in the back end. It's much more expensive to generate tokens than to do search algorithms. So it just made me wonder, you know, especially as people are flip-flopping in the same Copilot application between programming in the week and gaming on the weekend, who's paying for that? And how do you control who's paying for that? Because I'm guessing if they're using it for programming 5 days a week and gaming on the weekends, that I'm assuming that this is an enterprise account, right? So that means the enterprises are paying for the weekend of gaming advice, and we're definitely going to have to come up with a solution. Like, that will catch up with companies. And I don't know if it's a matter of like, we're going to need like expense reports about your query, like which queries were actually for work, but it is something to think about. It will, you know, it will catch up with whoever is paying for these plans.
Yeah, for sure. It's funny to think that, yeah, like they'll sort of, a guy will come around and be like, wait, you were using Claude Code for something that you like were just like some personal project on the weekend. Is your prediction then that like people get like a lot more restrictive on it over time? Like we're living in this great moment right now where people have like access to pretty expensive AIs that they can use for all of their personal needs. But largely this is kind of like almost subsidized, like a corporate benefit.
Yeah, either that. I mean, I saw a post, a funny post saying, when you negotiate your job offer, you should be negotiating your token budget too. So I don't know if it'll be something like that. And it's like a bring your own plan, like we move to bring your own devices, but it will have to be figured out one way or another.
Lokmar, there's a part of me that looks at these results and also thinks a little bit about how much of this is just tied to how Microsoft has been marketing the product. You know, there's almost kind of a funny thing where they say like, oh, we're surprised that people are using the technology for this, where I think the one brain cell view of it is like, well, yeah, you told people to use the product like this. And I think, like, do you think these numbers vary significantly across, like, you know, what you'd see if you looked at Claude's usage data or OpenAI's usage data? Like, how much do you think, like, it actually depends quite a lot on the platform in question? Or are we just kind of seeing, like, this is just a general median pattern that you'll see across the board?
So I think with protocol with Microsoft, it's a very large consumer population, right? And so, and it's very broad because you just go into an enterprise and the enterprises kind of did a blanket acquisition of licenses. And so I think it's almost like a study of psychology where you see what are the topics of interest. And then I think there's probably a bias. I mean, similar to what Chris said, that, you know, it's probably what we saw with Google. I think we are seeing a reflection of, I need knowledge I don't own or I don't have, and I want to have a clarification. I mean, I'm only asking for things where I don't have the knowledge myself. So it's probably interesting to see. I mean, like we started dumping everything we get from a doctor into a large language model, right? Like all the medical results, and then you actually get diagnoses which are either just confirming your doctor's results, or, you know, you have an ability to actually talk about them, you know, with the results you received. And so I think we are seeing a trend towards like using it almost as an expert model. And then hobbies, et cetera. But I think it's a good cut through. I would like to see the demographic breakdown. So where you see, you know, like the 14-year-olds versus the 60-year-olds, and then also the, you know, male versus female. It would be really interesting to see those types of breakdowns, because I'm sure there are extreme biases.
Yeah, I believe there's like probably just like huge differences in that. That's really interesting. Yeah, we should tell them to do that on the next round. Krish, maybe a final question on that is, you know, I'd be remiss if we didn't bring up the privacy question here, which is sort of like looming a little bit in the background. And I remember a number of years ago, OkCupid, the dating site, got into hot water because they started to do this data blog where they said, here's all these really interesting results about how we're A/B testing people. And people like were like, oh, I don't want my dating site to do that. And even further back, right, I think there's a lot of controversy around, you know, people were like, oh, well, if Google knows everything this about, like what people are doing, they should just start a hedge fund, right? Because they know what people are going to buy next before the market does. And there's a way to kind of exploit that. And so I would say, for what it's worth, it's not like Microsoft has gotten a huge like backlash for this report they've done. Do you think the norms around this are changing? Like people just generally just accept the idea that companies are going to look at this data and use this data, or, you know, are you worried at all on the privacy side of this?
Yeah, I mean, Lauren was just, I mean, talking about, I mean, all these issues from the enterprise perspective, but yeah, I mean, from the personal perspective, I think the norms are changing. So I think kids these days are like more than happy to be like tracked, that where their physical location is with their parents, with their friends, and all of that stuff. Yeah, I mean, like Volkmar was saying, this is an investigation into the minds, right? I mean, the psychology of people. So it's like, yeah, I mean, maybe it's okay for some of the folks that, something is just tracking their thinking in some ways. So I'm not there yet, but I think some people are getting there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Your threat level is rising, but it's not yet at, you know, Kush crisis mode level. So.
Yeah.
I'm going to move us on to our next topic. This is a topic that's been kicking around for a little bit. I'm glad we finally have a chance to talk about it today. So there has been the rise of kind of, you know, maybe prompting is the wrong way to talk about it, but really kind of like a strategy for sort of managing and tasking coding agents, which has become known as the Ralph Wiggum strategy. And there's already, you know, this is going to be a popular thing because there's already multiple conflicting interpretations about what it actually even is. You know, I thought it was particularly interesting because, you know, there's sort of a notion for coding agents, and I think sort of an instinct, certainly someone like myself who's like formerly a software engineer, which is you really want to look over the shoulder of the software engineer or agent and tell the agent everything you wanted to do in very strong particulars. And in part, the Ralph Wiggum strategy is like total naive strategy, right? Where the idea is basically like you give the coding agent some really simple instructions, and when it fails, you just tell it to loop against those instructions until it solves the problem. And this has turned out to be like really, really pretty good at doing a number of, you know, coding tasks. And so I guess, Lauren, a question for you. I guess I kind of look at that and I'm like, you know, the human always wants to be involved, always wants to show their intelligence. But is kind of the Ralph Wiggum strategy revealing that like we're really not that much needed anymore in like getting these agents to do what we need them to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is the underlying problem of like you really have to babysit. And it almost feels there's like questions constantly coming back from the agent about should I proceed this way? And it's almost always yes. Or the whole point of using it is that you just want to be able to say yes.
Yeah, just tapping
it about it. Right. So, it feels like when I'm like talking to a customer service bot and then I move away from the window and then I forget I was talking to them. And then they're like, are you there? Are you there? Closing this out. And I didn't get what I wanted. It's like I go back to the coding agent, I'm still like I forgot to answer a question and then I lost all this time. So I think that that's a very valid problem. I think this technique helps with that a lot. You don't have to babysit and constantly remember to check back in the terminal. But I also think that you have to give it much better instructions. It's kind of just front loading the work, right? Like you have to give it much better instructions and you have to be more thoughtful and spend more time doing your initial prompt if you really want this to be successful. And I'm finding myself more and more thinking through what instructions I know I'd have to give and then just saying, forget it, I'm just going to do it myself. Because, you know, before I was fascinated, like, can it do this? So I would sit there and give the instructions. But now I'm like,
the novelty is gone.
Yeah. So I think it kind of just shifts the problem. Maybe some people prefer that or in some cases, so that works. But it's a solution. It's probably not the solution.
Volkmar, I think the way these discussions usually go at MOE is now someone chimes in is like, well, but not for enterprise, right? You can push enter all the time if you're doing casual stuff at home, but not for enterprise. Are you still kind of that view? Or does Ralph Wiggum kind of reveal like maybe that there's change around the corner, even for like more serious kinds of like software engineering and development?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think in general, I ran sufficiently large teams of engineers, and I feel like a lot of what I'm doing with AI now is what I used to do with, like, you know, 100 engineers. And it's just like the turnaround is much faster, right? So I think if you look at these whole agent-based systems, we are effectively giving... So first, we are in engineering in general, from a management perspective, we are lazy giving good instructions, okay? Because it's just like, okay, it's a lot of work, so I need to sit down with the engineer and I need to describe exactly what I want. Or I just hire a PhD and they better read my mind. And I think we are still in, you know, I mean, and this is what you're doing, right? You're discussing like here the pros and cons of a system, and then you assume they have 20 years of education that they can fill in the gaps, right? So with an AI system, they just don't fill in the gaps. And so now you're more like, oh, I just have an entry-level hire, and that person actually doesn't understand much, and he cannot read my mind. And so therefore, I need to give very precise instructions. That's how I feel right now with coding agents. I was like, can you read my mind, please? Like, you know how this works? And I think what this is effectively saying is like, it's a self-correcting system, right? You're saying, I give you really poor instructions, and you don't come back to me. Why didn't you try a little bit longer, right? So it's like, it's an internship. And so the I think we are in a world where we are at loops where it's just still extremely expensive to run these loops. But if the cost goes down, number one, and two, if the loop we went through actually goes back into the training system, then that loop will collapse, because that's in the end the difference between, you know, highly educated or like long, many years in the industry person, because they fill in the gaps because they can read your mind. And so I think what Lauren just said, you know, it's a lot about giving very precise instructions or babysitting it through. But still, I mean, you know, if you babysit something through, which can produce 1,000 lines of code, a typical engineer produces like 100 to 200 a day if they really work, then, you know, you still get a huge benefit. And you're kind of massaging it through and you don't need to do it yourself. So I think there is it's almost the externalization of something that should happen in the training system. Maybe, and this is the big question, is like, maybe we are actually the trainers, giving Claude and Anthropic, right, and all those guys the training sets so they can make their systems better and we pay for it.
Yeah, it's kind of funny to think about. Like, we really don't like giving very detailed instructions. So, you know, we invented a whole other, like, we invented PMs to like help develop this process. And I guess, I don't know, the only other question I want to ask on that, just to kind of like push it a little further, Volkmar, is like, do you think that like coding agents are going to make, like, it's going to cause people to become better managers, even of humans, because it like has basically forced us into this practice where we're like, we have to articulate better. I don't know if you buy that.
It's the argument, like, are you becoming a better manager when you have children, right? And I think you do, because you have more patience. So I think what it does is it shows that it kind of lights or brings into the front how poorly we communicate. Right? Do we throw something over the fence? We are not describing what we really want. There's a lot of mind reading going on. And the system just goes off the rails. And so I think it's good in that sense. It, you know, like, how precise are we? And, you know, I think a lot of this, the gap filling, which happens with humans, and they go back and they ask their peers, et cetera, you know, the meeting after the meeting, what did he say? You know? And so I think that AI is less forgiving because there's no other place to go. And so you just see the outcome of your poor instructions.
Kush, there's a really interesting kind of safety question here, right? Which is, I think Lauren was pointing out basically the idea that, like, yeah, it's just annoying to have to keep pushing enter. Enter, enter, enter all the time. But like, the reason we have to push enter all the time is that companies like Anthropic have been like, we really want the technology to be as safe as possible. So please, 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 coding agent, keep checking in with the user. And I think stuff like Ralph Wiggum, but also in general, these kind of more chaotic, if you will, like software development patterns in coding agents, do they kind of suggest that the companies have been too safe? Like, that basically the agents are checking in way too much, and that actually the normal human safety aside is just like happy to let it run in a large number of cases, right? Except for enterprise, which of course we can talk about. But it's just kind of like the main thing that comes out of it for me is, well, maybe it just actually just turns out that, like, yeah, Anthropic's being way too paranoid. They should just actually the consumer would be better off if they let the agent just run without checking in. Do you buy that?
Yeah, we're going to be talking about this India summit later on, but there's this terminology that originates in India called Jugaar, so Jugaar innovation and so forth. And that's, I mean, what I see with this Ralph Wiggum sort of approach. You just kind of, like Volkmar was saying before, right? I mean, it's like the intern who doesn't have a lot of experience. So it's just trying things, kind of kludging things together and not worrying about the safety aspects. And I think it's perfectly fine, right? I mean, you can, for your personal projects, I mean, not have that safety and stuff, not worry about it, and just, like, build. And I think that makes sense. And then, like you're saying, I mean, when you're coming to this more enterprise sort of setting where you want more reliability and robustness, then maybe there's other ways to go. And I know in the past on the podcast, we've talked about generative computing, the sort of thing that IBM research is pushing as a more structured way to use AI for stuff. And I think it's just choosing the right tools, the right ways of doing things for the right approach.
And I do want to press that, actually. I've been making a little fun of it through the episode, but I think in future episodes of MOE, I want to really kind of like test like how careful is Enterprise on some of these things, right? And how much does like our kind of like at-home coding practices kind of infect what we do at Enterprise as well? But I think it's another discussion for another day. Krish, you mentioned the India AI Impact Summit, which is, I think, the other topic that I wanted to cover. Just to give some background on this, and Krish, would just love your kind of opinion on it. This is another big international summit on AI that is happening this year in India. It follows on a kind of series of big international gatherings on AI. The previous one was in Paris. I think there's actually an MOE episode where we broadcast from there. And then before that, there was a kind of UK-based AI action summit. So it's kind of an ongoing series of sort of big international gatherings about the technology and how do we go about doing sort of global governance in the technology. Krish, I know you work on governance, you know, in your daily life when you're not here on MOE. And so kind of curious about like what you're looking out for this year at the summit and, you know, what you think the trends are in the world of AI governance.
Yeah, I'm excited about this Impact Summit that's coming up next week. It reminds me of like in the late 1800s, all these world's fairs that used to happen. I think it's like a reimagining of that. And it was really interesting. I mean, these things used to happen and they would showcase all sorts of things like the Eiffel Tower and ice cream cones and whatever, cotton
now
candy.
Now it's just Opus 4.6 or whatever.
Yeah, exactly, right? But then they would, I mean, showcase new technologies as well, whatever, the telephone, the fax machine, or like the Corliss steam engine and all sorts of other stuff. And but like what was interesting with all of those things, which also was true, I think, in these first two Impact or AI, whatever AI summits, was that they also kind of have this tinge of like imperialism, like AI imperialism also, like, I mean, the classical like, colonialism imperialism back then, but the new version of it now. But that this thing is happening in India is actually like a complete reversal. Like it's going to be an opportunity to showcase like when it's the next billion people, not the top billion, but kind of like, or that decolonial sort of viewpoint. Like if you're starting with wanting to make an impact on agriculture or public health or financial inclusion or education or these sort of things, when it is really in a lower cost, low sort of resource setting, then what is the right way to go? I think that's what's going to emerge here. It's kind of like this alternative, like not the American style, not the Chinese style of AI, not the European style of AI, but something else. And I think the governance aspect of it is going to be like much more connected to like the social upliftment and so forth. So that's what I'm really, really excited to see what comes out.
Lauren, there's a speech that got popularized or like widely talked about from the Davos World Economic Forum summit this year. Mark Carney, who is prime minister in Canada, gave a big speech about how he feels that like middle powers, right, not like U.S. and China, but middle powers are kind of really where the action is, right? Where I think we focus a lot on like who are the leading labs, right? And there's kind of a view of like, oh, okay, there's basically only two people playing the AI game. But I think to Krish's point, it does feel like, you know, the middle powers have a lot to say in the world of AI. And so I guess curious if you kind of like buy sort of the argument that, you know, Carney's putting forth, but that you're kind of increasingly hearing on the scene, which is that, yeah, actually, if you're really interested about what the fate of this technology is, you do kind of have to like focus on sort of middle and rising powers, because that's where a lot of the future of the technology will be.
Yeah, I think that I think the main question there is how can we make sure those middle powers are exporters of AI technology, not just that they have the same access to it or the same applications of it, but actually making them producers and exporters. So I'm hoping a lot of the conversations for this Impact Summit will go there, and not just, you know, how can we use AI in local settings to solve local problems and do local leapfrogs, but really how can the whole global community be involved in producing AI? Because when the whole global community produces it, that also expands who can govern it as well. And to me, the ingredients are there to make this a reality because of open source. So you could replicate the whole AI stack with open source like in a weekend if you really wanted to, not just the open models, but the open inference engines, VLLM and OLAMA, and the open agent framework, SlangChain and CrewAI. So I hope a lot of the conversation goes there. I think open source is the way that we can make that happen, but it also kind of requires making open source the default stack as opposed to just lets everyone consume AI through APIs that are essentially black boxes.
And I think to take the most kind of like San Francisco Bay Area pilled view of this, you'd be like, well, what really matters is like what they're doing in the lab, like what the technologists are building and what the companies decide to do with the technology. Do you feel like a summit like this has leverage over the direction of the technology, or is it ultimately like this is going to be a corporate game? And, you know, like it or not, the leading labs do have a massive amount of leverage on what the fate of the technology is.
The technologies are getting adopted at you know, insane speeds. And I think we are there's a lot of people who are proactively trying to regulate it. I think it's a lot of regulatory capture as well. There is a lot about, you know, like, let's make sure that my friends get a seat at the table, right? So so I think that there's the innovation side, which is really clearly happening, you know, in Silicon Valley and in China. And then there is the what does it have? What's the impact on society, which is a lot about, you know, social impact. And we are seeing the first cracks. Right? I mean, you see the hiring numbers of students coming out of college, etc. So I think there is a component of almost, you know, we cannot go faster than 35 miles an hour with the railroad because everybody will go insane. So it feels almost like, you know, every regulator suddenly woke up and was like, finally, I have something to do. Like, you know, there's so many dangers. Let's go and regulate them. So that's the very cynical view here. But I think it's good to have the conversation. It's interesting to see that the rate and speed countries are coming and starting to talk about this. I think it's a good indicator how disruptive this technology is perceived, right? So that everybody and their brother actually needs to talk about it. And, you know, the governmental agencies and regulators and, you know, internationally, we are talking about what the impact is. So I think there is a clear perception of change, which is so, and it will be very pervasive in the organization in society. And so I think that's what I see it more as an indicator that, you know, this is not a, you know, oh, Silicon Valley invented, you know, the bike which stands around on your sidewalk, but it's actually something which is perceived as a fundamental change which is affecting very large swath of society. And so I'm seeing this more as a signal, not necessarily that, you know, something extremely valuable will come out of it. But I mean, awareness is the value, I think. And so people need to come together and talk about it.
I'm going to move us on to our very last topic. I was watching the Super Bowl this weekend, and it's a good time. And as you all know, this is also like a media phenomenon as much as a sports phenomenon. But I think the most shocking thing about the Super Bowl this year was basically it felt like every single ad was an AI ad, which is like a little bit mind-bending to me. And I think brought to mind, you know, the year for the Super Bowl where every ad was a crypto ad. I think, Lauren, maybe just turning to you, like, how should we think about the fact that every single ad was an AI ad? Is this the biggest sign of a bubble, or the biggest sign that, like, you know, we're finally breaking into the mainstream, seems to be the big question to me.
Yeah, I mean, they all had really different messages, which is interesting. Some were like, how do you use it better? What are the use cases? What can you build? I personally think the most interesting or like thought provocative one was the one by GenSpark, where Matthew Broderick and some other celebrities were advocating to take Monday off because you use AI, which, I mean, they made it into a joke, but that's actually really, really not a joke when you think of the economic implications. Because at the same time, you have Andreessen Horowitz last week posted this report suggesting that software development AI will contribute $1 trillion a year in value, because they did this math that there's 30 million developers, each produces about $100,000 of value, and AI can double their productivity. And that equals $1.5 trillion. So that's one extreme, because that's assuming that all those software devs, instead of taking Monday off, they pour all of their time gains back into doing more work, which is, and so I think that ad brought this really interesting, like, social question of who's going to capture the value in AI, because it, if it does go more in the direction of people just take Monday off, all the value capture will be in quality of life versus, you know, corporate squeezing more out of people. And those assumptions that investors are making right now, you know, some are here and some are here, those assumptions are going to, like, figure out, to your point, is this really all a big bubble? Like, who's going to capture the value? And are their investments today actually going to pan out the way they thought? So I mean, I think about that a lot, like, who's going to capture the value? And I'm glad they did that ad to put that seed in people's mind that maybe the benefit here is going to be quality of life more than doubling your productivity for,
like, you
your
get
company.
To work more.
Yeah.
Kush, what are these companies trying to achieve by advertising in the Super Bowl? You know, like, you're settling down with your friends, you want to watch some people, like, you know, tackle each other and throw a football around. It's not exactly the time you want to sit down and be like, oh, I should really adopt these technologies to improve my productivity, or, like, I should really consider these technologies to, like, you know, improve my ability to do B2B SaaS. What is the purpose of advertising at, like, something which is sort of so recreational and so not what we often talk about in AI, as the place where you're doing all these ads?
Yeah, I think it's mainly planting the seed, right? And I mean, Super Bowl is certainly the Super Bowl of advertising, but so in many other places too, whether it's tennis or car racing or whatever else, right? And so I think it's just, getting some people to just have that vocabulary floating around in their mind. And then when they take Monday off, and then when they're back at work on Tuesday, then they can maybe do a little bit of investigation. Should I go with this, go with that, whatever. So I think that's the main thing there. And one of the ads I found that was the most interesting, actually, was right before the trophy presentation. So there was one by Artlist, and I hadn't heard of them, but the ad was saying, basically kind of like a DeepSeek moment for all these other professions. They bought the ad space 8 days before the Super Bowl. They made the whole ad in 5 days for just $5,000. And really, I mean, we're just making the point of what Lauren was saying too, right? It's that you can compress all this, like, professional work down into like a very, very small amount of time compared to taking months and millions of dollars that other advertisers are spending and so forth. So I think that was kind of something that spoke to me, and it can't turn into, just intensifying work too much either, but just examples of it. So, yeah.
Volkmar, how about you? I don't know if you had any favorite ads or if you have any views on this in general. I think maybe one thing, just to kind of, you know, give you a little bit of a question, I think is, like, it does seem like one of the most interesting parts of this is that a lot of these companies are starting to differentiate more on brand, right? Where, you know, in the past it was like, well, you know, our model's the best because it's the best on the benchmarks. And that was, like, a really convincing thing for the market for a period of time. But we start to seem to be entering kind of a new phase of competition where part of it is just, like, the vibe, and is the vibe good, and that being something that the companies are actively sort of working on and trying to develop, to almost kind of signals a new era of kind of competition in some ways. I don't know if that's too grandiose for you.
I think we are still at the beginning. We don't yet know what the AI product is. I think we are kind of dabbling along, you know. And if you go back 2 years, it was like, wow, this thing can write me an essay. And now it's like, oh, it can write me a C++ compiler, right? So I think we are still at the point where the utility in the different domains is actually figured out. And so I think we're on the pre-stage, like, wow, I have dial-up. It's like, you can talk to the internet. Isn't that amazing? So I think we are still in the early stages. So, but I mean, we see a first inkling of, like, you know, consumer companies showing up and it being more packaged into products, which I find interesting. So the utility is not anymore like, hey, I can ask you a question, you give me an answer. But the utility is moving towards actually, you know, agents, specialists, you know, companions, all those things. And so I think we will get into, now that the core technology and the raw technology is kind of working, you know, we will fluff it up and, you know, give it, you know, rainbows and unicorns, and it will be, you know, more consumer friendly, you know, like the grandma using it. And so I think that's where we are getting to, and that separation now, you know, creates also different consumer groups and targets. And that's, I think, is also why this explosion of advertising. It's just like it's a positioning, it's a land grab, it's a mindshare land grab. I think OpenAI suddenly is not the only game in town, so now the ads, you know, start, because we're trying to get our subscribers. And if you think about it, it's a subscriber business, right? I mean, and there will be a saturation. So I think everybody kind of by now who is interested in tech has their favorite, you know, thing. Some have three. I have five because I tried them out. So I have literally five subscriptions, which is really annoying. But, you know,
annoying.
You know, you go between them and you're like, oh, okay, this one is doing this and this one is better. But I think there will be. So right now, it seems like the free token model is somewhat limited. I think the economics don't work out. We cannot give it away. Except if you get an advertising business working so that someone else pays for it. And so I think we will have the Netflix subscription or the phone service subscription, you know, where you effectively, if you want to have access to AI, you get the cheap and easy and simple one directly on your phone. And then anything which is more sophisticated, you will actually have to pay for. And I think we are at that, if that's the land grab, it's the cell phone providers having a cell phone and then everybody having a cell phone and you're fighting between who divides up the overall market. I think that's what I would interpret into this. We are probably at the point where we see saturation, like saturation of people who are willing to pay $10, $20, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of interesting as a signal for like, yeah, this is the window basically for the companies to have to build up the space before like the music stops on the musical chairs. I also really like the observation that like normally when you advertise, you know what it is that you're selling, but that we are in fact so early that like we're like the companies don't even know really what they're selling. And that's like a big feature of the space that we're in.
Okay, that's the other viewpoint. It's like there's so much Silicon Valley money going around. What do we do? Mm-hmm. Let's buy an ad, right?
Yeah, so. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a testament to venture capital.
Yes, is really correct. What it is. So, it's like, yeah, because exactly. There's clearly no profitability yet. So, yeah.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Kush, Volkmar, Lauren, thanks for joining us as always. That's all the time that we have for today. And thanks for joining for all you listeners out there. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixer of Experts. IBM.
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 Even Club. IBM. Good enough.
It's clear that there's certain panelists who hate doing this. Volkmar and Chris.
Yeah.